Hi, everybody. My name is Norris Hammond, and I am indeed a grateful recovering alcoholic. Well, thank you for asking me. You would think, with as much food that's over there on that table, there would be at least one bad dish, but there's not. I said food will get these drunks out in a heartbeat, won't it? And we love it. Thanks for asking. Thanks for the basket at the hotel room, for the corsage. I checked in the hotel this afternoon, and I thought, my God, they got me mixed up with somebody else. They really... But I do appreciate that, and thank you so much for asking us. As Lorenda says, it's always good to play a part in your own sobriety. I was apologizing to James. I had to get up and leave right at the end of his talk earlier. I spent the week in Alexander City, and I have not gone back to Florence. So Lorenda and Amber came down, and I got this emergency phone call. They were lost out there in that traffic trying to find us, and I thought, my God, they're going to wind up in Tuscaloosa. So I had to run and do that. But thank you for asking us. I don't know. It took me a long time to get to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a lot smarter than y'all. A lot of this stuff didn't apply to me. I could pick and choose and do this thing like I wanted to. And consequently, I kept changing my sobriety date a lot. Howard J., one of Bandana Bob, you know Howard from up in old Lexington 449 group. Howard, I love Howard to death. Howard tells a story about how he said it took him a long time to get here, too. And Howard talks about getting caught in a speed trap one time in Killing, Alabama, where we live. He said he got big bad policemen pulled him over and came walking up to Howard. And he told Howard, he said, boy, I've been waiting on you all day. Howard said, got here just quick as I could, see. That's the way I was with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got here just as quick as I could, but it took me a long time to get here. My sobriety date is I took my last drink the last day of July in 1993, this time. I pick up my medallion on the 11th of August, because that's the day we buried my mother. And my mother was the one person who said, don't ever give up on it. You know, don't ever give up on me. She never gave up on me when a lot of other folks did, Jay, but my mother never did. So I always pick up my medallion, you know, and say, okay, Miss Ruby, you know, you were right by the grace of God. And I carry that medallion in my pocket. I carry some things. Actually, I carry three things in my pocket all the time. I carry the medallion to remind me of that sobriety date. I carry a half dollar that's dated 1988. That's to remind me that in 1988 I had 5 years of sobriety and relapsed. So I carry them so that they rub together, and I know that I'm just one drink away from another drunk. I also carry a little metal angel that a friend of mine gave me. And that's to remind me that there are angels among us. See, I believe that God speaks to me through people that he puts in my life. I believe that that's how I get his message and communicate with God, is through folks like you. I love the story that Gary from down in South Mississippi tells. He talks about the atheist who was telling one of his friends about being lost in a snowstorm in Alaska. And this atheist was saying to this friend, he said, I'd been out there for days, and I knew I was going to die, and I didn't know how I was going to get out, and I was about dead. I was about to freeze to death. I was about to starve to death. And I thought, well, all right, big boy, I've never believed in this God stuff, but if you're out there, I got to have some help. And this friend said, well, and he answered your prayer, didn't he? And the atheist said, oh no, an Eskimo came along and I followed him out, you see. So I believe that God puts Eskimos in my life. One time in my darkest hour, he gave me a whole room full of Eskimos, and you guys are still here, see, and I'm eternally grateful for that. I don't know. Shirley Thomas said, you need to have fun. You know, have fun is something that we do a lot of. Somebody told me early on in sobriety that if I had a sense of humor and believed in God, then I could lick this thing. And that served me well for quite a few years. I had two speeds when I drank, either dead stop or wide open. You know, there was two things I could not stand, and that's an empty bottle or a full one. I need it going somewhere in between, you see. And my drug of choice was more. You know, whatever you have, whatever I could get, that's what I wanted, more. I was born about two drinks short, two drinks low. Because if you check me, I always needed two drinks so I could go in and start out with you. If I was going to a party or going somewhere to a function, I needed two drinks to get me up even with you. I was just born two drinks low. I was like the guy that was walking on the beach, hung over, and kicked the bottle, and the genie hopped out. You may have heard the story. The little genie came out and told him, said, you can have three wishes. The guy said, I want a bottle that never goes dry, stays empty all the time. Poof, he had it. He was shaking. He took him two or three big hits off of that, looked at it, and it was still right full. He got feeling a little bit better and kept that one down. He hit it three or four big slugs, and down it went again. He looked at it, and it was perfectly full. He hit it again. Still full. The genie said, look here, you got two more wishes. He says, give me two more just like this. And that's the way I was. See, I could never get enough. I was always afraid I was going to run out. And have y'all ever noticed that there ain't nothing looks more like a bottle in a brown paper bag than a bottle in a brown paper bag? Now, I've already told you I was a lot smarter than y'all. I was a real rocket scientist. If y'all happened to figure out that that was a bottle in a brown paper bag, I drank vodka so y'all couldn't smell it, you see. And this is aristocrat vodka. This is pretty good stuff here. And I just noticed that it's got a warning on the back of it, y'all. And it's a government warning to boot. And it says, according to the Surgeon General, women should not drink alcoholic beverages during pregnancy because of the risk of birth defects. It says, consumption of alcoholic beverages impairs your ability to drive a car or operate machinery and may cause health problems. My Lord, if I'd known that, I'd never drank. Now, good alcoholic that I am, I could rationalize that right away. You see, rationalization was my strong point. And a lot of this stuff just didn't apply to me. I'm certainly not a woman and I'm not pregnant, so that doesn't apply to me. I'm not going to operate any machinery, so that doesn't apply to me. And my goodness, they got to put something on there about health problems so the Surgeon General can get his paycheck. None of that applied to me. Holly Martin was one of my heroes. Holly used to say that rationalization is like masturbation. You're just screwing yourself in the long run. This bottle of Aristocrat vodka is $2.17 in the Alabama ABC liquor store. $2.17. That's brown paper bag, Alabama tax, out the door. Before the next few minutes is gone, I want to show you where it costs more than that. I want to show you where it costs a radio station, an apartment house, a grocery store, variety shop, 5 trips to a treatment center, jails, hospitals, car wrecks, and untold pain and suffering. And I'm not going to say anything new. I'm not going to say anything that hasn't been said by another alcoholic somewhere in a room just like this. What I might do is I might say it a little differently so it might resonate a little louder and maybe help somebody. At least it'll help me remember where I am and where I come from. There's a book that I like a lot, Chuck C. Chuck talks about, Chuck lived in Laguna Beach, California. And in the book he talks about his house set up on a cliff and overlooked the ocean. And he said he'd sit there in that easy chair and he'd look out that picture window and he'd marvel at the beach and the ocean and the sunset. And he'd sit there drunk. And he sobered up and he'd sit in that same easy chair and look out that same picture window at that same ocean and that same beach at that same sunset. But what he saw drunk and what he saw sober were entirely two different things. So what had changed? It's the same ocean, the same beach. What had changed was his perception of what is. And that's what I want to talk to you guys about for a few minutes. I want to talk to you. He calls his book A New Pair of Glasses. And I want to talk to you about how I got my new pair of glasses and how my perception has changed about not only this fellowship, but about life and what life is all about. I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous probably 30 years ago. And when I walked in the room first time, there were steps on the wall, the traditions, and the blue book, and the podium, a bunch of folks sitting around talking to one another. You know what? I walk in today, here you are, the blue book, the steps, the traditions, a bunch of folks sitting around talking to one another. But what I see today and what I saw 30 years ago, entirely two different things. So my perception is what we're going to talk about. Amber asked me, said, how many hours are you going to talk, Daddy? I said, well, not too long, babe. She said, good. Oh, we'll talk a little bit about Amber and my life in a little bit. But I guess I ought to give you some. I grew up in Lexington, Alabama. I used to say I had 16 years of continuous sobriety once. And then on my 16th birthday, I got my driver's license and I got drunk. And I began my journey to become a real alcoholic, like the big book talks about. And if I get real honest, I can tell you that becoming the real alcoholic is about the only thing I ever stayed with long enough or worked at hard enough to be called a total and complete success at, you see. My family was in business. They had a grocery store and a dollar store operation. I am the oldest of 4 kids, and I am the only one who turned out to be an alcoholic. We grew up, we were not carried to church on a regular basis. My grandparents on my mother's side were Primitive Baptist, and my grandparents on my dad's side were Church of Christ. So that was one of those things that we just never, that was the hole in the middle of the floor that we all walked around, and I was not carried to church on a regular basis. Always knew there was a God. We went to church on special occasions and homecomings and those kinds of things. But I didn't have a personal relationship with God. It was kind of like our president. I know we've got a president. I just don't know him, you know. He's there. That's the way I was with that. I finished school in Lexington, Alabama, and won a scholarship to Middle Tennessee School of Broadcasting in Nashville to learn how to be a radio announcer. Went off up there and came back and did, and went to work in a radio station in Pulaski, Tennessee. While I was there, I went to Martin College, met a little girl. We fell in love and started talking about getting married. And I was still drinking all the time, but I was always surrounded by a lot of loving and caring people, and they liked to have loved for and cared for me to death, and I knew how to play them all. I had never had to pay any consequences for what I was doing. One day, Miss Carol said to me, she said, Norris, someday you're going to make somebody a good husband, but it's not going to be me because you drink too much. Whoa. That gave me a perfect reason to ratchet my drinking to another level. Now, I'm a real rocket scientist, and I figure things out. So what I decided I would do is join the Army. Now, here's my thinking. I thought, I'll go off to the war. Vietnam was about to get going pretty good. I'll go off to the war. I'll be a war hero. And when I come home, she's going to love me. Made perfect sense to me. So I enlisted in the Army, and that was not a real bright thing to have done. I volunteered for a lot of things that I had no business volunteering for. Wound up going airborne. Wound up in a special forces team. 52 jumps out of an airplane. A couple of times around the world. Tour in Vietnam. Extended for a year. When I came home, I was not a war hero. I was a loose cannon. I was in and out of every radio station in North Alabama and southern Middle Tennessee, and I didn't want anything getting in the way of my drinking. I done told you I can't stand an empty bottle or a full one. I got to have it going somewhere in between. And my family, we had that grocery store, and I'd always wind up coming back and working in the family business. I could go out and do all these crazy things, but I'd always come back home because they needed me, you see. Back in those days, what I would do, we're real close. Lexington, Alabama is right north of Joe Wheeler Dam. A little bitty wide spot in the road. And we're real close to the Tennessee state line, and there's beer joints up there. Minor Hill, Tennessee. Well, I'd go off up to Minor Hill, and I'd start having a few drinks. And I'd think, you know what? Pulaski is just about 15 miles up the road. I could go off up there, and they got some Aristocrat vodka. So I'd go up there and have me a few drinks of Aristocrat vodka, and I'd think, rocket scientist that I am, I'd think, if I go back through that little town in Minor Hill, that guy's going to catch me. What I better do is just spend the night. So I'd check in a motel room with one thing in mind, and that was to drink myself into oblivion. I would drink and pass out, drink and pass out, and do that until something moved me off dead center. Nobody would take a bad check on me, or I couldn't get it, or my dad would come and get me. And they knew where I was. And Dad would come and get me and bring me home, and he would sit in that living room, and I can remember as if it were yesterday. He had asked me, he'd say, "Narf, why don't you do that?" He'd say, "Why don't you take that first drink?" He'd say, "Don't you know when you take one drink, you're going to get drunk?" And I'd say, "Yeah." And he'd say, "Then why do you take that first drink?" And folks, let me tell you, I gave him the only answer that I knew. And every five-year-old kid in the world knows the answer to it. And it's just cause. Just cause. You can take a five-year-old kid with a claw hammer who just broke out a picture window, and you ask him, "Why did you do that?" And he'll tell you, "Just cause." You see, I did not know what was wrong with me. They did not know what was wrong with me. I thought I was moral. Somebody told me one time I needed companionship. Somebody else told me I needed religion. One time I had two different religions and somebody else's companion, and hell, I was still getting drunk, you know. I have to say this. If you're new, but if you are new in the program, don't be too hard on the people around you who don't understand why we do what we do. You see, they only see our behavior. We live on that Tennessee River, and people come from all over the world to fish in that river and fish swimming schools. And they've gotten pretty good about catching those fish now with the gear. They can spot them. And can you imagine for a minute that if this fisherman drops this bait down in that school of fish, and this fish sees it, and he thinks he's found dinner, and he bites into it, but instead of dinner, he feels that hook set in his lip, and he feels the pain, and he tries to get away, and he swims and flops, but he can't. Every time he tries, it just gets deeper and deeper and hurts more and more. And these other fish look at him, and they see him behaving the way he is, trying to get away, and they think, what's wrong with him? Why is he not normal? You see, they can't see the hook. All they see is his behavior. I had a preacher friend who lost a son in a head-on car wreck one time. First time he'd ever had a family member close. He said, Norris, he said, I have preached many funerals. And he said, I've stood there at the head of that casket and shook hands with that family and said, you have my sympathy. He said, I didn't have a clue what I was talking about. See, and I couldn't resist the temptation to tell him he could better understand why one old drunk can talk to another old drunk. See, because you can see my hook and you can feel my pain. I got married in 1971, went off to Marietta, Georgia to work in a family grocery store over there. My son was born in 72. Morning he was born, I started celebrating and got drunk, wound up getting a DUI, spent the night in jail. Georgia wasn't working out for us. We loaded up. Sam Phillips had bought a couple of radio stations in Florence, and I came back. He thought I ought to be his news director, and we loaded up and came back to Florence, Alabama, and I went to work there, and I was doing play-by-play for the University of North Alabama and traveling with the football team, and we were doing a coach's show. After the ball game, Coach Mickey Andrews was there. We would sit there, and he'd analyze the game, do the TV thing. I got drunk on television. And you know what happened to that job? A couple of buddies of mine were putting a radio station on the air in Pulaski, Tennessee, 1975. And I went back to Pulaski, Tennessee to work for them as their news director. And I had come full circle. I was right back where I started, working at a radio station in Pulaski, Tennessee. You see, if nothing changes, nothing changes. If you keep on doing what you always done, you're going to always get what you always got. And that was a hard lesson for this drunk to learn. I'd been drunk for about 2 weeks. I'd run my wife off and son. They'd come back to Lexington to my family. I'd been held up in the house. I had not bathed or shaved or done any of that. I don't know if anybody can identify with that kind of social drinking. But I had an attorney and a mechanic make a 12-step call on me, and they asked me if I thought I had a drinking problem, and I would have admitted to anything to have gotten out of where I was. I would have admitted shooting President Kennedy. It wouldn't have mattered. They loaded me up and carried me to the VA hospital in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, 1975. I went through an 8-day detox program in a nut ward. And that's a whole other story for another time. After I sobered up, I went through a 28-day treatment program up there. Came back out of there and negotiated myself into buying a radio station over in Perry County, Tennessee. when we're straight, all this manipulation and all this stuff that we alcoholics do, when we get it channeled in the right direction, we can pull off some pretty fancy deals. So I went off over there with a radio station, and for those of you who don't know, Perry County, Tennessee is not the end of the world, but you can see it from there, I'll tell you. That was 1976, and I was not drinking, not doing anything. I just wasn't drinking and working, and we wound up with that radio station in a variety shop, and we had an apartment house, some cars and some stuff, and we'd had a party. America was 200 years old in 76, and they'd had a party down at my house, and I hadn't drank, and I was real proud of myself. And I don't know, a few nights after that, I was down in the kitchen making me a ham sandwich, and I opened the lettuce drawer, and there was a Miller Pony in there, a little Miller Pony. Some of you remember them little jewels. I took that thing out, undid it, drank it down, threw it in the garbage can, and 6 years later, I lit. I had lost radio station, apartment house, variety shop, cars, the whole smear. I tell everybody I reached my break-even point financially. I owed about as many people as I didn't owe. And we slipped out of Perry County, Tennessee on the cover of darkness and came back to Lexington, Alabama for me to work in the family grocery business because they needed me. You see? Sometimes I forget to share this. I need to, if you hear me around these rooms, I will tell you that I believe there's something good that everything that happens to me. Now, sometimes I can't see it right away. Sometimes it takes a while and I have to search for it, but there is a lesson to be learned or an experience gained, something good in everything that happens to me. Unless I find the good quality in it, I can never accept it. Okay. I was a full-blown alcoholic in 1976, and I got introduced to cocaine in Perry County. The fact that a line of cocaine cost $100 would not have bothered me. I would have written checks, stole, done whatever I needed to have done to have gotten it. But to me, it wasn't $100. It was a case of whiskey. I said, my gosh, that's a case of whiskey. I can stay drunk on a case of whiskey all week. I don't need that. And I turned, walked away, and never looked back. The fact that I had already found my choice, I had already found the love of my life and alcohol, saved me from making that journey that I would readily have made. I mean, I would have went, because I would have gone, but it was a case of whiskey. So there is something good in everything that happens to us, and I believe that to be true today as well. I came back to I got to hurry and sober up because I got a lot of good stuff to talk about. I came back to Lexington working in the family business, and I done told y'all I can't save a drink. It's got to be going somewhere in between, and I'm a shaker. It puts me in the bed when I hit it. And Colbert County had gone wet, but in order to get to it, you had to go 10 miles and you had to cross Joe Wheeler Dam. Now, Joe Wheeler Dam is exactly a mile long, and it's narrow. And when you're in the kind of shape I am, getting across Joe Wheeler Dam to get to the liquor store, which is Wayne's Package Store right on the other side, I mean, it's a real deal, and there's log trucks and stuff out there that'll run over you. So what I discovered was that a 24-ounce bottle of Listerine would settle me down enough that I could operate a motor vehicle and get to the liquor store. Now, it's important for you to know that Listerine is not my drug of choice. However, if you do drink Listerine, you don't have bad breath and all that lot of plaque and a lot of other stuff that you otherwise might have. I can still walk by a display of it in the grocery store and get indigestion. But I suffer from what the big book describes as the phenomenon of craving. And when I take any form of alcohol in any shape, form, or fashion, my body says, get me some more of that stuff and get it quick. And I respond to what my body tells me to do, even if it's Listerine. And I drank Listerine, folks, not because I wanted to, but because I had to. I had to. I wound up in a stone blackout on Listerine, had a wreck, hit a lady. Thank God it didn't kill her or hurt anything, tore up some cars. I woke up in jail. They had me charged with, no driver's license, driving on revoked, hit and run, DUI, leaving the scene of an accident, all kinds of stuff that they had me charged with. I was guilty of all of it, except they had me charged with possession. They had found a wine bottle under the seat. And Lord knows, if I'd have had any wine, I wouldn't have been drinking Listerine, I was doing all the stuff that I needed to do to get out of what I'd gotten myself into, And they had sent me to a DUI school, and I had been back to treatment. I had been to the 28-day program in Tuscaloosa and in and out of hospitals and the whole thing, the deal. But I was in this DUI class. They made me go to AA meetings three nights a week, and I had to go to DUI school two nights a week, and it was pretty intense. It was about 2 hours, and they did tapes and lectures and all that kind of stuff. And this was 1982. And they ran a tape one night about a lady doctor who was doing cancer research down in Houston, Texas. And she needed warm human brain tissue. And she would ride around with the Houston Police Department and find these winos that had died. And she would rush them back to the hospital. And she made a remark one day down in the snack bar. She said, "Isn't it strange that these winos are not only alcoholics, but they're also hooked on heroin?" And they laughed at her. They said, "Who are you kidding? These guys can't afford a cheap bottle of Muscatel, let alone be on heroin." What she had discovered was a substance called tetrahydroisoquinoline, or THIQ for short. It's a substance found in heroin. She had assumed that since it was in their body, they had been using heroin. Back to the laboratory anyway. What we know now is that for some of us, the way our bodies eliminate alcohol when we drink, we actually manufacture this stuff called THIQ. It had been around since World War II as a painkiller, but they didn't use it because it was highly addictive. And so the big book, Dr. Silkworth, what a grasp he had for this disease in 1939 when, in the doctor's opinion, he writes about the phenomenon of craving, you see. And I heard that and I said, "Run that tape back by me again. I want to hear that." I thought, "Do you suppose that there is something physically wrong with me that makes me do what I do? That I'm not just a no-good, low-life SOB? That I'm just not lack of willpower? That I just am? Is there something physically that makes me do what I do?" And I hung my hat on that, and I began my journey to recovery. And I went to the noon meeting of the Florence Open Door Group of Alcoholics Anonymous every day. I wound up working in that same DUI school where I got sober. I wound up doing an early morning talk TV show. I wound up working in a treatment center as their marketing director. And 5 years went by. And in 1988, my disease talked to me. And when my disease talks to me, it's usually disguised as common sense. And my disease said to me one day, said, "Norris, now you know you got this THIQ stuff and you can't drink." I said, "You betcha, I'm a dead dog if I do." And my disease said, "I tell you what I bet you could do. I bet you could smoke a joint." Made sense to me, a rocket scientist that I am. So I smoked me a joint. In 48 hours, I had a half a gallon. In 48 hours, I was back in treatment, this time in Warrior, you see. And in Warrior, that's where I learned, baby, that prayer don't work. I had a counselor down there that didn't like me. He told me that I was the lowest piece of you-know-what that God had ever put on this earth, and I would never amount to anything, and it'd just be a blessing if I just get on out of the way. I was just a no good. And, y'all, I prayed as hard as I ever prayed. I prayed night and day for him to die, and he didn't. And I did that 28 days. And if you know anything about Warrior, just before you get to Interstate 65, there is a Wayne's package store right there. And that's where I showed him who was in charge of my life. And I got drunk at him and stayed drunk for a while. And God gave me the job that I have today in 1989. Allows me to travel. I'm in a different town every week. We do a deal with funeral homes. But anyway, I had been working for them for about 6 months. I had been, my home office is in Gastonia, North Carolina. I had not called in. I had not done anything. I had traded station wagons. I was in a different car. I was in Scottsboro, Alabama. I'd been drunk for a week. I was sitting on a bar stool, and this bar stool was located in a real dive, y'all. It was off the beaten path. I mean, it was a place. And my boss in Gastonia, North Carolina, was on his way to Birmingham. And he coincidentally drove through Scottsboro. And he coincidentally turned down that dirt street where that old joint was. And for some strange, unexplained reason, he looked over and saw a 41 tag on that station wagon. And just a matter of coincidence, he stopped and came in. And he walked up behind me and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "Hey, bud, what are you doing?" And I looked around and saw who it was and I gave him that old answer. I said, "You can't fire me, I quit." And God sent me an Eskimo. He said, "No, you don't quit." He said, "I've seen some people that wasn't worth saving, but you are." And so he snatched me out of that bar, sobered me up, and the rest is history. They sent me to treatment. I got a DUI in Mississippi. They sent me to treatment in Center, Alabama.